we're starting in, we finished last week the first set of discourses in Proverbs, where we pick up in verse 8 of chapter 1 through the end of chapter 1, and we saw the my son, wisdom and folly. And so this is lesson 6 of the my son wisdom, lesson 6 of the series in Proverbs. This is the third section on my son wisdom and the folly discourses. And my hope is to cover all of chapter 2 today, though we have a lot of nuance. We're not going to get to all of it, so if I'm skipping something that looks like we ought to have a little more attention there, let me know and we'll see if we can't work in the material. So let's, I apologize for a small print, but that's what it takes to get this to fit on the screen. So let's read this chapter here. My son, if you receive my words and treasure my commands within you, so that you incline your ear to wisdom and apply your heart to understanding. Yes, if you cry out for discernment and lift up your voice for understanding, if you seek her as silver and search for her as for hidden treasures, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth come knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield to those who walk uprightly. He guards the paths of justice and preserves the way of his saints. Then you will understand righteousness and justice, equity and every good path. When wisdom enters your heart and knowledge is pleasant to your soul, discretion will preserve you, understanding will keep you, to deliver you from the way of evil, from the man who speaks perverse things, from those who leave the paths of uprightness to walk in the ways of darkness, who rejoice in doing evil and delight in the perversity of the wicked, whose ways are crooked and who are devious in their paths, to deliver you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words, who forsakes the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. For her house leads down to death and her paths to the dead. None who go to her return, nor do they regain the paths of life, so that you may walk in the way of goodness and keep to the paths of righteousness. For the upright will dwell in a land and the blameless will remain in it. But the wicked will be cut off from the earth and the unfaithful will be uprooted from it. So once again, I'll draw your attention to the way Solomon initiates each of these segments. These are often called the my son segments. This is the advice of a parent to his son, particularly as his son, but not limited in application. In this chapter, there's some very specific warnings to the guys given, but Solomon here is again using that tender language. My son, I need you to listen to what I'm saying. This is important for you to follow. And before we dissect the text, I want to bring one new literary device that we're finding in Proverbs. I think this is the first time this device is used. We've looked at a number of types of Proverbs, and we'll mention those as we proceed. There are still many more types to come, but chiasms or a chiasmus, depending on what you're used to there. A chiasm is a figure of speech in which two or more clauses are related to each other through the reversal of structures in order to make a larger point. That is, the clauses display inverted parallelism. So one of the hopes that I have is that some of the work, the literary beauty of Proverbs will emerge as you're reading it, as you find these word pictures painted and you need them to settle so that you can meditate on the beauty of what has been constructed. Proverbs is a very densely written book. It's very sparse in the number of words that it uses. And a chiasm is a frequent literary device throughout the whole of the Bible. Well, it's common to extra-biblical literature as well. But it's used quite a bit in Proverbs. And there actually seems to be a fair number of people dedicated to identifying all the chiastic structures in the Scripture. Some of them seem fairly far-fetched in my mind, but others are not. So the name comes from the Greek letter chi, which is shaped like an X. It looks like uppercase X. Many chiasms are in the form of A, B, B, and A. They get increasingly more complex. The simplest structure by necessity is A, B, B, A, but you'll find A, B, C, C, B, A. This comes from, there's a beautiful example in Genesis 6. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. And you see this breakdown. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man his blood shall be shed. Now there are chiastic structures that attempt to take the entire chapter or large segments of chapters and show how they revolve around a certain point. But some of this is difficult to see in English, depending on how it's been translated. So I don't want you to worry that you're unable to see the chiasms especially in Proverbs, because they can be difficult to spot. So I'm not identifying each type of proverb whenever we encounter. I'm not going to categorize each one. I'm not going to illustrate each of the chiastic structures, but I may mention them from time to time. In Hebrew, in these poetic books, this wisdom literature, remember that the rhyming technique is not a rhyme of words. They're not limericks in the sense that we use the idea, nor will you find the same meter structure employed. The reason is that the Hebrews rhymed thoughts or ideas. So they would give an idea and then maybe restate the idea in some sort of parallel fashion, so that you could understand they were emphasizing this. And when you see a chiastic structure, it's there to illustrate the thought rhyme, and also to show what the point revolves around. So sometimes you might see an A B C B A structure, and that should direct your attention that there's a couple of rhyming pairs centered on this middle point C. Now in this Genesis 9:6 passage, we're seeing that the rhymes start at the outside and work their way in, so there's a perfect parallel given. But that's not always the case. So the point of this is the writers of our Old Testament scriptures work very diligently in demonstrating literary creativity when they work on these chiasms. And so you'll find them a lot. And ABBA is the classic structure, so keep that in mind as we move through. And the first chiasm that I'm aware of in Proverbs, I want to show you why it's difficult to spot these things. My son, if you receive my words and treasure my commands within you, is a chiastic structure from just verse 1. However, in English, the translators differ in how they render this, but the Hebrew wording is a bit closer to my son, if you receive my words and my command you treasure within you. You see, that's not stated the same way, is it? That's a very different structure. So the ABBA chiasm then is, if you receive my words, my commands, you will treasure. That's where the thought rhyming takes place. That's the goal of this. Now, one of the reasons people employed these devices is not simply that they wanted their agent to spot them so they could get a book out on a bestseller list, right? There are lots of literary devices employed to help you remember and to help you build these thoughts. So while it's worded maybe a little awkwardly for our English translations, my son, if you receive my words and my command you treasure within you, there is a sense in which that sticks. You can see the revolving point and you can see the parallelism there. You can also see parallelism in the way it's rendered most commonly in our modern English translations. If you receive my words and treasure my commands within you. So that X sign is where we get the word for the chiastic structure. And it's easier to spot when you know the original word order. And that's not visible to everyone all the time, but you can imagine switching the word order and creating a chiastic structure. If that happens, it could be that that's what the author did, and our English translations just do it a little differently. So before we move away from this, are there any questions about these chiastic structures? They still exist today. People still employ these. I think maybe the most famous modern one is Kennedy's speech, you know, ask not what you can do for your country, or however it's worded, but ask what your country can do for you, whatever, the other way around, yeah. It's memorable to some, it's obviously not memorable to me, but you get the idea. It's a chiastic structure, whatever it was meant to say. I'd rather, if you receive my words and treasure my commands, that's a chiasm I want to memorize, but that's, you get the idea. So it's a literary device still used, but maybe not frequently identified as such. So before we move on, do you have any questions about chiasms? All right. ABBA is the structure we're using. And I wanted to make this point because it's important that this is a puzzle, I agree, and perhaps a literary device, I'm not sure, but it's not a chiastic structure. So some people are real fans of it, as you can see down at the bottom, but I am not one, but there are people that are fans of these things. So it's too bad he's not here. That would have been great. All right, so let's take apart Proverbs 2, 1 through 4. Proverbs 2, 1 through 4 is largely structured as an if-then-so proverb. My son, if you receive my words and treasure my commands within you, so that you incline your ear to wisdom and apply your heart to understanding, yes, if you cry out for discernment and lift up your voice for understanding, if you seek her as silver and search for her as for hidden treasures. So there are four pair of conditions that exist within this grouping. And the opening of Proverbs 2 deals with the acquisition of wisdom, the acquisition of wisdom. And I think you could probably group it different ways, but what I've settled on is looking at these effective verbs, if you receive and treasure, and then you see incline and apply, then cry and lift, and then the seek and the search. These are all very active words to describe something, right? They're not really very passive. You might think that the word receive there has a passive connotation to it, but I think that's more English than it is in Hebrew. You might see take to heart or accept what I'm saying as a bit closer to the meaning than the idea of just receive, just take, but there's some action involved here. I also see some parallelism between verses 1 and verses 4, some thought symmetry between the two. Both involve taking what is available and hiding what is treasured or searching for hidden treasure. So you get the idea that In verse 1, that what I'm trying to explain to you is so important, you should treasure this. And then down in verse 4, you should search for her as for hidden treasure. So I see verses 1 and 4 thought rhyming and putting together an idea of the value of wisdom. So I don't know if you see those things. Your mileage may vary, and that's fine. This is a literary analysis, and people are going to see different things and get different things from it. But I also see a sort of pairing in verses 2 and 3 as well. So the dual pairing here involves the inner you, the inside of you. And there's another literary device here. We saw it last week. We'll see it again. But what's the literary device being used here in verses 2 and 3? What do you see there? It's the same one we saw last week. There's a sense of personification in this, that it's the ear that's being inclined, right? There's a It's not the exact form of personification we see, but I think there's something there. And when you look at these verses, the picture that Solomon wants us is incline your ear. Well, I mean, who inclines their ear to hear? All of you are looking straight ahead right now. Nobody's inclining their ear, physically inclining. But it's a beautiful picture. Yeah, I'll speak up. That's right. It's a beautiful picture of how we are involved, body and soul, in this approach of wisdom. And throughout Proverbs, there are lots of these concrete word pictures about abstract ideas, right? The abstract idea is receiving and treasuring. I mean, that's not something you necessarily see at face value with someone, right? I mean, that's, you can't tell what they're receiving, you can't tell what they're treasuring. But the picture he wants to have in mind is incline your ear, lean forward, get into this and hear carefully what's being said, and then apply your heart to it. Crying out for discernment. Crying out for discernment. That's a beautiful picture. Now it's not the ear and the heart, but it's the inside of us making a noise. Lift up your voice, either in a wail or a shriek, a holler, that something to indicate that the inside of you is being provoked to acquire something of value. That's the idea. Something important is before you, and you need to reach for it and get it. So there's a sense of earnestness, there's a sense of value, and action implied all within these first four verses here. So I told you we're going to move fairly quickly. There's a lot in here today. So in Proverbs 2:5, we find, so we have the if clauses. If you receive my words, and you could add those words again, and if you treasure my commands, so that you incline your ear to wisdom and apply your heart to understanding. If you cry out for discernment, and if you lift up your voice, if you seek her as silver, and if you search for her, so the ifs are implied throughout those, we get to this point that comes in again and again, the first consequent. There are more, but this is the first consequent of Proverbs 2. Then you will understand the fear of the Lord, and you will find the knowledge of God. So what is it that we acquire when we've been crying out, when we've been diligent? What is the great goal of the book of Proverbs? It's the fear of what?
Fear of the Lord.
And who is this Lord we're to fear? What's his name?
Yahweh.
That's right. It's the fear of this self-existent, eternal God who's made a covenant with his people. The fear of the Lord is the hinge upon which the whole book of Proverbs turns. And I know I've said it before, I'm going to keep saying it because it's the hinge. If you don't get this idea, you're simply not going to understand what is being requested or required or taught to you. The fear of the Lord is the hinge here. And it's depicted as a great treasure, as a prize, isn't it? This is not just you'll be a happier person. If these commands should be treasured because they're like silver. It's like a whole silver mine that exists that is yours for the taking. So again, this idea that we pick up from last week when the bestowal of wisdom from the parents to the children were ornaments and crowns. Remember that? That was the first enticement we saw. And then the parent, the father warning his son, if sinners come enticing you and they entice you this way, and we saw what the allure was, we find again that there's a very concrete way that the parents are speaking to their children about the value of wisdom. Here it's being portrayed as a treasure. And if you do these things, if you do these things, four times, if you do these things, then you're going to get this great treasure. All right, there's an oddity in verse 2 chapter 2, 5 that I don't quite understand, and I didn't find anybody that really, I think, explained it well, but you'll notice that it's, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. The word God is not used in Proverbs very often, less than a half dozen times by my reckoning, but Yahweh is used dozens upon dozens, 80, 90 sometimes, 100, I don't remember what the exact count is. It's huge. Yahweh is the name most often used, but yet there are these small number of times on why they're on the word God, and why that's the case, I don't know. But I don't think we're to take from this that knowledge of God is synonymous with the fear of the Lord. I think there is a difference there, but I'm at a loss to explain what that difference might be. Otto Zockler makes this note in his commentary that knowledge of God is here put not merely as a parallel idea to the fear of Jehovah or Yahweh, but it expresses a fruit and result of the fear of Jehovah. So he's thinking that this fear of Yahweh produces something in us, which is also called the knowledge of God. So another commentator named Woodsworth makes this point that this is one of the few instances where you find the word God used in Proverbs, where it's designated as Elohim or Elohim, and this appellation Jehovah occurring many more times. He says the almost singular exception seems to be then intentional, and the meaning will be the knowledge of Elohim as distinguished from the knowledge of man, the knowledge of man being of just little worth. So again, it's at least an idea there to tell us that there's something very important about this wisdom, there's something important about the knowledge, but I don't quite understand what the distinction is. The effect that Solomon has on this is lost to me right now. And we also find that this is another chiasm. Verse 2:5, Solomon writes another, has another chiastic structure. You will understand what? The fear of the Lord. God and the knowledge of, you'll find. So you don't see this in the English, but this was deliberate in the Hebrew. And so he's got it there that... for some device to help you remember it, I guess. All right, so let's pick up in verses 6 through 9. For the Lord gives wisdom, and from His mouth comes knowledge and understanding. We looked at this idea of the origin of wisdom when we opened the class in the preface. One of the critical points, and I find it a beautiful point, that's picked up on with our New Testament writers, who tell us that wisdom is ours for the taking. What do we need? What do the writers of the New Testament tell us what we need to do in order to obtain the wisdom that is available to us? Pay attention, but there's a little more to it than that. I didn't want to give away the reference and all it. But what are we told to do? What do the New Testament tells us if we lack wisdom? Just ask God for it. That's right. Ask God for wisdom and He'll give it to you. That's right, it's in James. So, it's interesting, isn't it, that the portrayal of wisdom is someone who cries out, someone who's making noise. It's all very public, right? It's not private. It's not hidden. You don't have to be a member of a certain club to have access to it. It's the word is written, the word's made available, the preaching of the word is public. People can download it on the internet. They can read the Bible. I mean, this is not a cult, right? And here we have a promise given to us in the New Testament that if any of you are lacking wisdom, ask, and God will give it to you. So, how many of you feel at times that your prayers are just not answered? Well, maybe if you want a higher answer rate in your prayers, then change what you're praying for. And one of the things you can begin asking is for wisdom. And we know it'll be answered because we're told so. James explicitly tells us that. But then when you get back to Proverbs 2:6, as we are on the trail of pursuing wisdom and pursuing knowledge, we find that it's the Lord who gives it. the Lord gives wisdom, and from his mouth come knowledge and understanding. It's a beautiful picture, and it's a great comfort to know that wisdom is ours for the taking. In verse 7, we see this idea that it's stored, that he stores up sound wisdom for the upright. In my mind, that takes us right back to the idea that we should seek it as silver. Silver's been stored up, right? Silver's been placed someplace where we can find it. That's what miners do, isn't it? They get down in there and they seek for it. If some of them are digging for gold, they look for it. If it's trying to extract diamonds, they get down there. If it's oil, whatever it is, they're in there working to get it. And we don't have to crawl under the earth to find wisdom. We have to open God's Word, ask Him to give it to us, read it, and there it is. Because He has stored this wisdom in His Word for us. So I see, again, a continuance of this picture of the valuable treasure that's been mentioned in the if part of these clauses. Again, in verses 7 through 9, we see the beauty of the application of wisdom. God becomes a shield. He's a shield for you. He guards you. And He preserves you. These are beautiful benefits, aren't they? To have a promise that God will shield, He will guard, and He will preserve you. Now, verse 9 is important. So we saw the first then of the chapter, right? Then you will have the fear of the Lord. And now we have a second consequent clause. We have another then. Then you will understand righteousness and justice, equity, and every good path. What I think we're getting at here, what I think Solomon is expressing to us, is this picture of wisdom that's being portrayed is something that you need, something that you should acquire, and you should do so diligently, receptively. And then the promise that it's the Lord who's going to do these things, and out of His Word, out of His mouth, I think that's the idea we have, comes all this knowledge and understanding, because it's stored up tight, and then here's how it's expressed. Here's what happens when you possess this wisdom. He becomes a shield for those who walk uprightly. He's guarding your path, the paths of justice. He's preserving the life of His saints. And when you acquire this, when you see this, when it begins to manifest, then you will understand certain things. Righteousness, justice, equity, and every good path. So I see, in a sense, a thought rhyme which tells us in verse 5, then you will understand. Right? That's the consequent. That's the first promise. You seek after wisdom, then you will understand. Well, what is it you're going to understand? Well, it's the fear of the Lord. What is the fear of the Lord? What is this? Well, one of the things the fear of the Lord is an understanding and a practice of righteousness, justice, equity, and every good path. That's the benefit being conveyed to us. So the second then expands on the first then. So if you can picture it as four ifs, and then this dramatic conclusion, which is the hinge for the whole book, then you find these three verses which start to explain it, and then the fourth one, which rhymes back with the first then, that says this is what you should understand. This is what it's going to look like in your life. It's not the only way it's going to look like, but this is one of the ways it looks like. So I think there's another thought rhyme here where the content of the fear of the Lord is brought to expand against the with righteousness, justice, equity, and every good path. That's an awful lot. That's a lot of material, and I'm in full speed right now. So, does that make sense? Is this clicking? So I think this idea of seeing the gradual expanse in this section of Proverbs, we're not going to do it. When we get to chapter 10, we can't act this way, because I don't think there is an outline and an order from chapter 10. At least through 29. So, but right now there is. There's another There's another idea that we need to have worked within us. And I don't know if I'm right in this or not, but I'm calling it the chief metaphor. So I want to distinguish our devices here. So the fear of the Lord is the hinge, and that will be on the test. The fear of the Lord is the hinge. If you don't get it, you're not going to get anything out of this book. You might get some helpful life advice here and there, but you're not going to get the message of the book. But the fear of the Lord is not the metaphor. And there's a difference. The fear of the Lord drives the content and the object of Proverbs, but it isn't the chief metaphor of Proverbs. What is, then, the chief metaphor? Well, I'm suggesting that the use of way or path being the course of your life as being the chief metaphor. You're going to see these words come up again and again all throughout the book. And I think it makes sense to think in these terms because the Hebrew mind would have... Well, I'll get to that in just a minute. So we look in verse 7. We want you to walk uprightly. Well, where? In the way or in the path. It's implied. In verse 8, the paths of justice, the way of his saints. Every good path, that's where this righteousness, this justice, this equity, where does it exist? On the good paths. So I think it's critical that we begin seeing that Proverbs has a way of working itself out in your life. Now, I don't literally mean each step that you're taking, but I do mean it includes each step you're taking. What activities are you going to? What are you doing with your life? The course of your life is what's referred to as the way and the path. And this is going to come up a lot throughout our study. It's not just here, it's throughout. So if you can get this idea that the chief hinge is the fear of the Lord and the chief metaphor, at least until I encounter another metaphor which seems bigger, then we'll categorize it. But the chief metaphor right now is that of the course of your life, the way and the path. This is really important. And it's important because it's a very Hebrew way of thinking. How to walk and how to think are deeply united in Hebrew thought. The idea of separating these things would not have been of interest to them. Thomas Chalmers has this quote, that the righteousness of our conduct contributes to the enlightenment of our creed. Which I think is a really helpful way of showing the relationship between the practices of our life, how we're conducting ourselves, and what it is that we understand. When you know, I'm sure you've met people who are very, very bright, but they live a godless life. And whatever testimony they attempt to bring to the table about what God is, who He is, or what He's done, you sort of discount it, don't you? You think, well, you know, he doesn't treat his wife well. He doesn't have a good testimony at work. He doesn't manage his money. He doesn't do what the whole book of Proverbs says he ought to be doing. He may be academically smart. He may have understood all of the words that were used, but he hasn't been able to implement them. And the idea of not implementing what it is that you've been taught is an utterly foreign concept to these ancient Hebrews. So look at verse 7, 8, and 9 again as we look at the enlightenment that comes in the course of our life. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He's a shield to those who walk uprightly. I see a connection there. I see a relationship there. He guards the paths of justice, preserves the way of his saints. Then you will understand. When you know how to think about these problems and you start obeying, you'll understand. That's the promise being communicated here, is that learning how to think and learning how to obey are tightly tied together. Does that make sense? Are we good? All right. Ten and 11. Wisdom enters your heart, and knowledge is pleasant to your soul. Discretion will preserve you, and understanding will keep you. We have here another word picture, which I think sets the tone for the rest of the chapter. We're at a pivot point. We just got through the first consequences. If this, if this, if this, then. Let me explain again. Then, and now, we're into the visible application here. And I think the tone is set for the rest of the chapter. It's only when wisdom has entered your heart and knowledge is pleasant to your soul. That's a beautiful picture right there. It's only when those two conditions are met that you begin to reap the rewards that are listed in the rest of the chapter about the pleasantness and the uprightness. When wisdom will enter your heart, when it's been diligently sought for, as we've outlined above. So how do you get it? Well, you receive and treasure it. You incline and apply it. You cry out for it. You lift up your voice. You seek and you search. You ask God for wisdom in His Word, and He gives it to you. And when all this receiving and all this searching and this crying and this lifting and this application is done, then something happens within. It changes you. You're no longer the same person you once were. You are a different person. You will have this knowledge, or the fear of Yahweh will become pleasant to you. Now, that's not going to happen to somebody who's unconverted, right? Somebody who's unconverted is not going to have his heart warmed with the commands and the precepts and the knowledge of God. I mean, they're at odds with it. They're at enmity, right? The natural man doesn't have a capacity to understand these things. But that's exactly what's being said here, is that this will become pleasant to your soul. Knowledge meaning perception, skill, discernment, understanding, wisdom. Again, we're in this problem that we have so many nuanced English words, and the Hebrew had a much fuller definition within one word than we have. So we expand on it. But it's a beautiful picture to see that this stuff actually pays off not just in the walk, but it changes you on the inside, and God's things become pleasant to you. John Trapp, who's a very witty commentator, has an observation about this idea of knowledge being pleasant to your soul. And he writes at the end of this verse, "True joy is serious business." True joy is a solid or serious business. You really want to be happy in life? You've got to work at it. And you work at it by becoming wise in the fear of the Lord. All right, we still have a lot to cover, and I want to finish the chapter today. Verses 12 through 15. When you've done all these things, when wisdom is pleasant to your soul, when you finally got it, and you see that it's going to preserve you, and it's going to keep you where? On your path, on your way. What happens? Well, it's to deliver you from the ways of evil. It's from the man who speaks perverse things, from those who leave the paths of uprightness to walk in the ways of darkness. They rejoice in this doing of evil, delight in the perversity of their wicked ways. Their ways are crooked. They're devious in all their paths. Ways and paths, ways and paths, ways and paths. It was there at the beginning, and it's here again. That's the contrast that Solomon wants you to see. The way of the upright, they have righteousness and equity and justice. They have peace. This stuff is pleasant to them. The other guys, well, not so much, right? They're perverse. They're crooked. They're evil. They're wicked. In the same ways, in the course of their life, they're on this trail, you're on that trail, but both of you are on a trail. Both of you have a course of action for your life. It's a beautiful and striking comparison between those who have acquired wisdom and those who have not. The warnings of these wicked men are really, really heinous. They're, we'll see what happens to them in just a little bit, but you don't have to imagine hard to see that if you're in the way of darkness, you're not going to see the light, are you? You're not going to see what hits you next. You're in the path of darkness. You are perverse. You're twisted. Your ways are all crooked. You don't know where you're headed. You don't know what's going to happen at the end. And when it happens, it's going to hit hard because you can't see it. You don't understand it. You don't have any visibility for it. These are all the things you should take from verses 12 through 15. Then we get to 16 and 19, and we're first warned about these evil men, and now we're warned about this woman, and she is a piece of work. Now, in verse 16, your translations may differ. The New King James says the immoral woman, but she's not just called immoral. There are other translations have she's immoral, she's the strange woman, she's profane, she's the adulteress. Are all words that I believe I've seen in various English translations, and those ideas are all good. And the behind that word, I mean, when you the word strange is also very good, but it you need to back up just a little bit to make sure you remember what how this word strange is used. In Numbers 3 and 4, if you remember, Nadab and Abihu provoked, or they offered what? A strange fire before the Lord, right? They didn't do what God commanded. This, I don't know what you guys are doing, but I did not tell you to do that. Now stop. In Deuteronomy 32:16, they provoked him to jealousy with strange or with foreign gods. In Psalm 54, we see strangers have risen up against me. And what's the point he's trying to make there? Well, these aren't my brothers. These are the strangers. These are people who don't belong. And some have argued that this woman is a prostitute. I don't know that we need to jump to that conclusion. I think this idea of strange is reasonable, and it includes within it the immoral person who's acting in an immoral way. So I don't know that we need to categorize her as a prostitute in order to see the why she's giving the destruction. She is a stranger because she doesn't belong to you. Right? I mean, that's the strangeness of her, isn't it? She belongs to someone else. She's a stranger to you. Margaret's not a stranger to me. You can divide the world into two categories, right? Margaret and everybody else, right? Everybody, all the other, what do we got, 7 billion people? 3.5 billion people, save one, are strangers to me. That's the category they're in. They don't belong to me. Margaret does. So this woman is a strange woman, I think, in part because she's got a husband. That's the idea, that she forsakes the what? The companion of her youth. And this is the language you find in Malachi, in chapter 2, when God is bringing his divorce indictment against God's people. Why are you doing this? Well, because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth. There's a striking similarity here, the way this woman is acting. So I think calling her strange is good, because she's turned aside from that which is hers and gone on a path, isn't it? She's walking down a different path, and she's going to end up doing some real wickedness. Now, what happens? What is she doing? And guys, you need to be aware of this. So she's the seductress, right? She's the seductress who flatters with her words. Now, I think she's got more than just words to entice. But you don't stand a chance, guys. You don't stand a chance. She knows what she's doing. You're on your path, but if you're not discerning, right? That was the promise that was given to us, is that we would discern. Discretion will preserve you, and understanding will keep you. If you don't have that, then when you start listening and you start looking, she's got a hook in you. And I'm telling you, you don't stand a chance against these women. When we think of women in Proverbs, we're often drawn to the beauty of what's depicted in Proverbs 31. But for the first 30 chapters of Proverbs, most of the women are not portrayed in a very flattering light. And that's because young guys... My son, that's where we started this, my son, are usually thinking about one thing and one thing only. And if you don't think that's true, you don't understand guys. Solomon thinks it's true. My son, I'm telling you, this woman out here, she's out to get you. And the way she looks and the words she uses, you don't stand a chance. So you need wisdom and fear to keep you on your path, so you don't end up on a strange path. All right. Here we've got paths. This, in the third time, we see it again. So I want, we're very close to the end, and I know this has been very quick, but I think I can finish here. This last section, 20 through 22, is another beautiful example in Hebrew thinking. So as we're reading this, you know, to deliver you, none who go to her return, nor do they regain the paths of life. And verse 20, so that you may walk in the way of goodness. And here we're back to ways and paths. Keep to the paths of righteousness. For the upright will dwell in land, and blameless will remain in it. The wicked will be cut off from the earth, and the unfaithful will be uprooted. Again, we're back to paths. Watch the way you walk. So the ways and the paths of wicked men and women are dark, they're perverse, they're crooked, and they lead to death. The ways and the paths of righteousness, they lead to life. That's the contrast. Chapter 2 is a study in contrast. It goes on and on with parallelism and rhyming and contrast and metaphor to reinforce again and again. My son, if you seek her, seek what? Her, right? Her. It's the feminine form of the word wisdom. If you seek her and not the other her. If you seek her as silver and gold, you'll get it. But this verse, this word in 20, the way 20 opens is a little different than maybe, than it caught me off guard the more I was thinking about it. So, I mean, we use it as a conjunction and adverb. We've got different uses, but it seems so mild, doesn't it? And I think there's a little more here than what meets the eye. I think the idea in so is to state a strong conclusion, something along the lines of, in order that you do these things, in order that you may walk in the way of goodness, I want you to acquire this wisdom and to avoid these people to the end that you may walk in the way of goodness. I want you to avoid these people for this reason, that you may walk in the way of goodness. That's a slightly different way of thinking about the conclusion being drawn in 20. It's very important that we understand this way of thinking. And so I've got a quote here from Dan Phillips, again, about this so in verse 20. And it's a beautiful quote. If you do as I say, then you will receive my wisdom, which will deliver you from evil, so that you can walk in my ways. If you wanted to summarize Proverbs 2, I think he's done a good job in terms of seeing how the connections go together in the way wisdom works with us. If you do as I say, then you will receive my wisdom, which will deliver you from evil, so that you can walk in my ways. See the uniting of the way the Hebrew is, I need to teach you so that you can walk. I need you to be discerning and understanding. I need you to have skill and cunning. That's what knowledge means, skill and cunning. I need you to be adept so that you can walk in my ways. This is all tied to obedience. So you do need to cry out to God for wisdom, but that wisdom should be expressed in your life in some capacity, in the path and in the way you walk. That was really fast. But I didn't want to break this chapter into two, so I apologize for the speed. But I'll take any comments or questions while we have just a few minutes. Bruce.
So when the verse where it says, she forsakes the covenants of her God, notice the G is capital there. So you sort of think of this immoral woman as being, you know, totally outside of the covenants of God, but this looks like she's...
Well, I think she's an Israelite.
Yeah, so yeah. Somebody who's grown up with the language of Christianity and would know how to smooth talk it to sound legit.
Sure. Yeah, there's sort of a backhanded warning here. Fathers and mothers, raise your daughters well. I couldn't prove this, but I think this woman is an Israelite. I think that's the impression. You need to be careful out there. And don't think that just because she has the right words, she's safe. So it's in a sense it's a backhanded instruction to the parents. You need to raise your sons and your daughters. There's more on that in weeks to come, by the way. So, and remember, just because it says my son doesn't mean the girls are not included. And they're not included just because they're devious plots. Solomon, that's not the point here. What else? What other comments you have? Danny?
I was wondering if you could, like, touch on kind of, like, how the wisdom of God differentiates from just wisdom in general, I guess. Because there are a lot of, like, really upstanding people who really appreciate the wisdom of Proverbs and really appreciate the wisdom of the Bible, but they don't necessarily, they're not convinced by the gospel, they don't necessarily believe Jesus is the Son of God, or, you know, they see that there's something there, and I don't know, like, just as an example, I know a lot of Mormons who are very upstanding citizens. And they would say they believe in the Bible and they apply the wisdom, and they do in many ways. So, like, how does that differentiate from the fear of the Lord in the context of the gospel, I guess?
Well, that's a good question. Briefly, that the fear of the Lord is something that happens for people who are regenerated. As we discussed in the book, John Bunyan's Fear of God, there are many different applications of the fear, many different levels and applications. And it's not at all unthinkable that people can be affected by the fear of God, but in an unconverted way. They're still not regenerate when they're done with that. So lots of people are going to read these things and think that this is what I'm doing. I'm trying to do all these things, but it's never, wisdom has never been a pleasantness to their soul in the way that it's being communicated here, because they've never been internally regenerate. And the path thereon, though their life may not have the sort of gross destruction that's portrayed here, they're on a path of destruction because they haven't given their life to walking in Jehovah's fear. So it took 20 weeks or whatever to teach that class on the nuances of the fear of God. So I don't know that I can do a whole lot more.
Reading that book, actually.
Oh, three cheers. That's a good book. All right, any other comments or questions? All right, next week we'll take a look at the fourth installment in this series of the My Son Wisdom and Folly Discourses. Let's pray. Father, we do ask that you would give us wisdom and that you would grant it to us liberally so that we may have this pleasantness in our soul as we think and meditate upon all that you've done for us. Direct each of our steps and guide our ways and secure our paths, that we may be blameless before you all the days of our life. Amen.